You're listening to the Accidental Creative Podcast. Since 2005, we've delivered weekly tips to help you be prolific, brilliant, and healthy. My name is Todd Henry. I'm your host. This episode is sponsored in part by MarPipe. MarPipe is the new multivariate testing platform for Facebook ad creative that lets you do creative testing better. The average MarPipe customer reports that their ad performance doubles in less than 30 days. So if you're spending over $25,000 a month on Facebook advertising, you need MarPipe today. Visit marpipe.com/accidental to book a free demo. This episode is also sponsored in part by OMS Photo. To make a marketing campaign successful requires a great message and a visual that's fantastic. That's where OMS comes in. They deliver full-service photo and video production. Whether it's products, lifestyle, drinks, splash, food, or portraits, the creatives at OMS are there to make any idea a reality. Go to omsphoto.com today to view their fantastic photography, retouching, and video portfolios. The words love and work are rarely used in the same sentence, right? Work is comprised of those tasks we have to do in order to make a living, while love is used to describe those activities that are driven by passion. But what if love and work don't have to be mutually exclusive? What if we can discover what we love through our work and not just in spite of it? Today's guest is international best-selling author Marcus Buckingham. Marcus believes that love and work are not mutually exclusive and that you can, in fact, do your best work when you understand what you actually love. We discuss why work is not just about a job, how to discover your weird, W-Y-R-D, and even why George Clooney's sister doesn't act. It's a great conversation. Marcus's new book is called Love and Work. Here's Marcus Buckingham. Well, there are a few guests that I have frequently been requested to bring on the show who have never been on the show before. And today's guest is someone that I frequently am requested to invite. And I think I've reached out a couple of times. We finally were able to make it work. I'm thrilled to have him. He is an international best-selling author of many books. You're all going to know who he is. It's Marcus Buckingham. Marcus, welcome to the Accidental Creative Podcast.
Thank you, sir. I'd love you to be here.
So I've been following your work for a very long time. I'm very familiar with your work, your past books. You have a new book that is has just released. It's called Love and Work, How to Find What You Love, Love What You Do, and Do It for the Rest of Your Life. It's a big promise. I'm excited to talk with you about it. Why did you decide to write this book right now?
Well, The last 3 years for me certainly have been a really, last 4 years have been one of those times where you stop and reassess all sorts of things and what kind of contribution you're trying to make in the world. I lost my father. We had the pandemic. My family, my kids went through a kind of a major trauma. And like many people during the pandemic, you go down pretty deep and you look in the mirror, and there's some days when you have some pretty dark days when you're trying to figure out who you are and what your identity is in the world. And then there are other days when you kind of see things clearly and you're like, you know, we're here for such a short time. What is the contribution that you can uniquely make? And are you really stepping into that lovingly, but are you really stepping into that as seriously and as passionately as you could? And I think I've done quite a few things over the years in terms of books and articles and research and building a company, but I've normally relied on data. I'm a psychometrician, so I'm measuring things about talent or engagement or resilience, and that's great. But I'd never really played out my story in terms of how you can actually find what you love what you do, and contribute it. And I feel like everyone's life is a story. And if I wanted to truly affect, in a positive way, people's contribution, then you sort of have to do it in the context, not just of reliable data, but you've got to do it in the context of story. So I felt like this was a great time to step out and try to do that to help people.
So when people think about work, they usually conflate that with job, right? That's usually how they think about it. And you, in some ways, you kind of blow up that concept in the book. Why do you think we need to expand our view of what work actually is?
Well, the whole point here of life, right, is that you have, every single one of us is completely unique. We have 100 trillion synaptic connections in our brains by the time we're 19. And those synaptic connections comprise a pattern that is shared by no one, not even the people in your same family. In fact, You're supremely different even from your brother or your sister or your cousins or the people you're closest to in terms of what interests you or what grabs your attention or what you love or when time flies by, when time drags. All of the incredibly specific appetites and loves that you have are so unique to you and are felt by you as loves, as an activity, a moment, a situation, a context, a piece of work, a discovery. All are completely unique to you. The world you see is seen by you alone and felt by you alone. And some of these activities, as they hit you thousands of times a day, lift you up. They're energetic. They are joyous. You find love within them, and the chemical cocktail in your brain actually looks very similar to when you are in love with another person. And love, like all things, is a force. It needs to be expressed. In fact, if you don't get a chance to express what you love in your work, love turns into a very destructive force and it eats you away from the inside. So life really is a search, not just for the things that you love, but it's also a search for expression. It's a search for a way in which you contribute. And of course, we think of work as just your job, but you contribute something of value in lots of domains of your life. And the way we define work in the book is it's anything of value you contribute or create for someone else, which could be your job, absolutely. But you have lots of other domains in your life in which you have a chance to contribute that which you love, your family, your community, your hobbies, your other creative outlets that you might have. And the search for a happy, thriving life isn't a search for balance. Work-life balance is one of those really destructive aspirations, not only because people can't find it, that moment of balance, but because if you ever did find it and you were saying, well, I've got the work balanced with the life, or the work balanced with my kids or my mom or my finances, or you would basically say to everyone around you, nobody move. I've got it just right, yeah. So. And so we look around, and of course, nothing healthy in nature is balanced. Nothing. Everything healthy in nature is moving, and is moving through its environment, getting the nourishment it needs to keep moving. Well, that's a good metaphor for our lives. So you need to express love through contribution in an integrated way. You don't have five cups to balance. You have one cup, your own cup of love, and it's either filled or empty of love. So that's why really thinking about the beautiful intersection, the infinity loop, if you like, between love feeding work, feeding love feeding work, that's the goal of our lives, to move through our lives in that way, all domains of our lives in that way, one of which is your job.
Yeah, I love that description. You introduced a concept early in the book, weird, not W-E-I-R-D, but W-Y-R-D. Could you share that concept and explain how that frames up your thinking about this topic?
Yeah, so the most powerful thing that you see when you look at nature is variation. Biology loves variety. All of natural selection is a function of, and only works because of, naturally occurring variation. In human beings, the variation is, as I described it, you've got more synaptic connections in your brain by the time you're 19 than there are stars in 5,000 Milky Ways. And no one helps you know anything about this. You're taught a lot about the differences of gender or race or age, and that's interesting and legitimate. You're taught maybe a lot about how people got to be who they are through their biography, through the traumas that they experienced, and maybe the different stories that they tell themselves about those traumas or about those experiences. And so you learn that George Clooney is George Clooney because, as George Clooney says, he has an aunt called Rosemary Clooney, and she, you know, inspired him to be who he was. And Neil Armstrong was an astronaut because his dad told him to get his pilot's license before his driver's license. And Serena Williams is Serena Williams because of her dad. And that's what you get told, which is legit. All of those facts are real. But really, if you really wanted to get to the heart of who are you really, you wouldn't want to know why George points to his aunt. You'd want to know why does he have a sister called Ada who isn't an actor. You've never heard of her. She's an accountant who specializes in payroll. Well, she has an aunt called Rosemary Clooney. And Neil Armstrong had a brother called Dean, who was a bank manager. And yes, Serena had her dad, but Venus had her dad too. And they couldn't play tennis any more differently. So the question you really want to get to in life is, who's helping me know why Ada and George Clooney are so different, or why Venus and Serena play tennis so completely differently, despite the fact that they have the same coach? Who's teaching me about my own uniqueness? No one is the short answer. No one helps you have a language or a ritual around that. So the first concept we tried to land was the idea, and it's a Norse idea, that inside of you is a weird, and that's a noun, W-Y-R-D. It means your spirit or your daimon. And for them, it was explicitly spiritual. You have a unique identity there within you, I promise, and it has nothing to do with your race, your gender, your age, or your experiences growing up. It was there when it was the unique clash of the chromosomes of your parents, out of which came this unbelievably filigreed and massive unique pattern of connections and networks. That's you. Now, the Norse had it as a spiritual concept. We now know of the genetic and biological and neuronal underpinnings of it. But it's almost like I wanted to start off and say to people, no, you're in there and you aren't an artifact of what happened outside of you. There was something in there that's unique and distinct to you. And it was there, just like the Norse said, it was there from you at birth. And one of the most important things you got to do in your life is build a relationship with it. Get to know it. That doesn't mean that it stays static. We know the brain can grow in all sorts of wonderful ways throughout the course of your life, but it doesn't grow into someone else's brain. In fact, we know you grow more synaptic connections in the areas of your brain you have the most pre-existing synaptic connections. So actually, your weird gets more defined as you grow. Now, hopefully you get less defensive about things you're anxious about, or hopefully you find really productive ways to express your weird. But I was trying to land really hard that idea that inside of you, from the get-go, is this beautiful, unique, weird, W-I-R-D.
Yeah, I love that. It's such a great way to describe something that we all suspect, but we don't know how to put into words. I think so many great truths in life. I think it's like a river flowing underground. We hear it, but we don't know exactly where it is. But we know it's there. We just don't have the words to describe it. So I love that you introduced that into the lexicon. Now I'm going to borrow that phrase and credit you and use that phrase. It's fantastic. You give several, what I loved about this book is it's very practical. You give several signs of love, you call them, ways to identify those areas of love in your life. One of them that you've already mentioned is, you know, why doesn't George Clooney's sister act, which was, I think, a lovely question in the book. And that was in the context of talking about attention and where we place our attention. How can attention be a sign of love in our life and our work?
Well, one of the reasons we don't see the weird in ourselves, of course, is we're so close to the weird. It just feels like it's like the fish who doesn't see the water, and you're just in the middle of it. You're so close to it, you don't see yourself. But nature, in a sense, has given us clues to demystify ourselves. By the way, that's one of the things I hope the book does for people, is it changes their relationships to their day. Normally, we think of a day as something to get through, something to withstand. A to-do list that flows over from yesterday. But if you could flip your brain on your day, it's actually trying to put on a show for you. Every day it's trying to show you this moment, this situation, this context, this thing I'm working on, that like thousands of stimuli hit you. It's like the day is doing a dance for you and say, how about this and how about this? And your clues to your weird are what you love. So your loves, like the point of the book, at least the first part of the book, is let me teach you how to use your loves as your language, or your signposts into who you are. There are signs of love. Again, wouldn't it be great if we took this as seriously as we take geometry? There's 10 years of geometry all the way through high school. There's not 10 years on signs of how to use what you love to discover who you really are and how you can contribute. So to some extent, the book was trying to fill in that void. But attention is a great one. The place where you begin is what you instinctively pay attention to is what you value. Now, you might think, well, everyone pays attention to the same things. Oh, my word, they so don't. Why are you reading the back of a cereal box? Why do you do that? I know you think everyone does that, but they don't. You do. You're weird. That's your weird, not W-E. You know, that's your weird doing its thing. Yeah. I remember for me, I put this in the book, but it's when I was 9 years old, I noticed that when people are standing around watching other boys, I went to a boys' school, doing high jump, instinctively, every boy watching some other boy do the high jump, they instinctively either raise up on their tippy toes or they kick their legs out. And then when you turn to them and you say, why are you doing that? They go, I'm not doing that. I'm not doing that. But then you watch them and they do it again. They instinctively, humans are watching someone do the high jump. They leap up a little bit. I remember even at 9 going to my math teacher, then to my science teacher, my gym teacher going, what's going on? Why is everyone doing this? And then denying they're doing it. I was just paying attention to something. I thought everyone could see it. It turns out I was one of the few people that paid attention to it. And I'm probably the only one in the school who was geeked out by it. So I didn't know what I was going to do with that. But that's something that I was paying attention to really early, actually probably became a foundation for wanting to be a researcher in life. I didn't know that 20 years later, an Italian professor and his team would find out the existence of mirror neurons that cause all of us, basically the foundation of empathy. As we watch someone try and leap over a high jump, we instinctively with our bodies trying to lift them over the top of it. I didn't know any of that, but I did know I was paying attention to something. So even at 9 years old, you can start probably to think back to when you were that age. What do you find yourself instinctively paying attention to? It's not random. Your patterns of attention are worth paying attention to because they're the first, there are other clues, but that's the first clue to that which you love because you pay attention to what you value.
This episode is sponsored in part by Marpipe. The secret of creative testing is this: no one knows what they're doing, right? From CMOs to marketing managers, everyone is just making it up as they go. They're faking it. And if that's you, you're safe with us. Confess, admit you know it. Then make your life a whole lot easier and finally know that you know with Marpipe. Marpipe is the new multivariate testing platform for Facebook ad creative that lets you do creative testing better. The average Marpipe customer reports that their ad performance doubles in less than 30 days. Now, this is not some shady offer you find in your spam folder. Marpipe is an Adobe-backed ad tech platform that is remaking the digital creative industry. It's deceptively simple. Just upload your assets to Marpipe, and Marpipe will create hundreds of ad variants and seamlessly launch them with one click. One of the things I have despised about doing ad creative is that you're basically kind of guessing, right? You're kind of throwing things out that you think might work, and then you have to wait for the numbers to come back. And often this involves so much work and remaking and retesting and trying to figure out what's going to work. Marpipe makes it so simple because Marpipe does all of the hard upfront work for you. It's so easy to use. It's so simple. It's so brilliant. Marpipe works with companies that are spending tens of thousands on Facebook to brand, such as Mars, Tubi, and Quip. And Business Insider calls Marpipe the money ball of ad creative. So if you're spending over $25,000 a month on Facebook advertising, you need Marpipe today. Book a free demo at marpipe.com/accidental right now and get a free $2,000 credit. But don't wait. This offer is only for a limited time. Sign up for your free demo and get a free $2,000 credit at marpipe.com/accidental. That's marpipe.com/accidental. This episode is also sponsored in part by OMS Photo. OMS is an impressive photo and video studio with an in-house photo retouching team. To make a marketing campaign successful requires a great message and eye-catching content, and that's where OMS comes in. They deliver full-service photo and video production. Whether it's products, lifestyle, drinks, splash, food, or portraits, the creatives at OMS are there to make any idea a reality. With studios in Cincinnati, Denver, and Orlando, their team is uniquely talented to scale to meet various brand needs, everything from CPG to high-end advertising. So go to omsphoto.com to view their fantastic photography, retouching, and video portfolios. See why countless brands have trusted them to do the job right. Again, that's omsphoto.com, omsphoto.com. You know, we move through our days. Like, as you said, you know, days aren't something to be lived. We just move through them. We endure them. We get to the other side, but we don't pay attention to these patterns. You know, we don't listen for the patterns. Instead, we just see them as anomalies in our life, but often we experience these things over and over again, but we never step back to say, wait a minute, there's something bigger going on here. And one of the ways that you say that we begin to do that is by paying attention to our instincts. How do we know what to listen to and what to discard? How do we know which instincts are useful and which instincts are maybe less than useful to us in this process?
Well, certainly another clue to what you love is what you find yourself instinctively volunteering for. And often, of course, when we use the word patterns in psychology, we pathologize them. Because if you think about the verb that you're normally supposed to use with the word pattern, it's the verb break. You're supposed to break your patterns. Your patterns are bad. We are diving deep into your patterns to find the causes of all of your psychosis or your neurosis or whatever it is. And undoubtedly, some patterns can be self-destructive. But the whole point of this is to go, wait a minute, you have patterns of attention that are really interesting and unique and distinct to you. Investigate them. I'll tell you what else. You have patterns of volunteerism. You have patterns of stuff that you instinctively find your mental hand going up for. And all of them are worth paying attention to insofar as they can be turned into contribution. So remember, again, it's love and work. It's not love for narcissism's sake or self-involvement. It's love and contribution. So which ones should we pay attention to? We should pay attention to the ones that can lead us to contribution. That can lead us to contribution. It sort of goes back to the Ken Robinson thing of she's not sick, she's a dancer. So, and his famous TED talk, there was a kid who instinctively sort of, her instinct was to move all the time, and she was pathologized until someone said, no, she's a dancer. But actually, it's even more specific than that. My sister was a professional ballet dancer for 25 years. You can see just how rudimentary our understanding of our own instincts are, that when Ken says that, we all go, wow, yeah, she's not sick, she's a dancer. But actually, in the world of dance, there are a million kinds of dancers. Your whole podcast is focused on creativity and creative people. Well, creativity lives in the detail. You're not a dancer. You are a lyrical dancer, or you're an improvisational dancer, or you're a jazz dancer, and your instincts lead towards such detailed contributions. My sister went to the Royal Ballet Company, but it turns out she's not made for the classical ballet repertoire. She ended up, because her instincts took her to a very lyrical kind of dance, to a certain very well-known modern ballet company called the Netherlands Dance Theatre, which is all lyrical movement. It's not three pirouettes to the left, three to the right. It's a very specific sort of dance, and all of her instincts as a dancer took her in that direction. So we ought to get everybody, every single child, 9 on up, to pay attention to their instincts, because their instincts and what they instinctively volunteer for leads them wisely, often more wisely than the loving teachers and parents around them, towards specific kinds of contributions. That doesn't mean that every instinct is worth indulging. It means every instinct is worth taking seriously because of what it might turn into in terms of contribution and the detail of what that child might discover about their contribution.
In the final section of the book, you talk about 7 devils that can stand in the way of our discovering our love and making our contribution. And you actually quote Catherine Goldstein, which I love this quote, "The devil believes he is a force for good." And I think that is so true. I often share with leaders that fear often comes disguised as wisdom, right? That we often mistake fear for wisdom. Well, wouldn't it be better if, or maybe you should? And really, that's just fear kind of playing out. One of the 7 devils that you call out is the excellence curse, which I found really profound and would love if you could just describe that concept for us. Because I think this is something that plagues a lot of artists and creative pros and people who are people who have to make things up, people who have to invent things or solve problems or develop products for clients or whatever. This is something I think plagues them. What is the excellence curse?
Well, we define a strength usually as what you're good at, and a weakness is what you're bad at. Right from the get-go, I mean, all the way through, the conventional wisdom has those definitions. I'm not creating a straw man. The strength is what you're good at. Weakness is what you're bad at. But when you really peel that, it's odd, because there are some things that you're really, really good at that you hate, that drag you down, that bore you, that drain you, psychologically, weirdly damage you, but you're really good at them. We've all had some subjects we got A's in where it was like, if I ever have to do that subject again, like, shoot me. Well, what do you call that? What do you call something where you're really, really good at it, but it psychologically drains the energy out of you? A proper definition of that should be that's a weakness. A weakness is any activity that weakens you, which means actually that a strength is any activity that strengthens you. A strength is an activity that strengthens you. And you're the best judge of that. Love actually is the raw material for that. That's why the book's called Love and Work, because it's like your loves are the clue to what a strength is. And a strength is an activity or set of activities that strengthens you. Most of us struggle in our lives, not with not enough time. We have not enough energy. And so we're not really wise about how to use the raw material of life to nourish us. Well, let's flip that around and go, no. No one knows what your strengths are better than you. And no one knows what your weaknesses are better than you. Somebody else might judge your performance better than you. They might say, I loved that poem. I loved that painting. I didn't like that video game. Like their reactions are legit. And they can tell you their own reactions to what you made. Okay, that's fine. And you should probably listen to their reactions if you're a creative person. You know, if I write a book, I hope people will read it. But if they tell me I was bored by chapter 6, then that's their legit reaction. But what I love about what I do, that's owned by me. And the excellence curse is that other people keep telling us where we're good as though that's the truth that we need to metabolize. It isn't. The truth we really need to metabolize is which particular activities or situations or moments lift us up. They're so specific, they're so unique to us, and we are the only genius about them. Now, it's our responsibility to then turn them into contribution, and sometimes you're going to try to turn them into contribution, and people won't pay you to do that. That's called a hobby, and that's okay. Because it brings more love into your life. That's the use of hobbies, is that it brings more energy or nourishment into your life. But you're the judge of who you really are and how you draw nourishment from life. You're the judge. And that's an incredibly powerful self-mastery move to push other people's quote-unquote feedback aside and go, no. I know what my strengths are better than anyone because I know what strengthens me better than anyone.
Mm-hmm. And I love that you point that out, that you know, your work doesn't have to be something you're paid for. Your work is, as you said, someplace you add value. And so that could be a hobby. And sometimes, I mean, what ended up being my business, ended up being my actual job, started off as a hobby because it was something I was so drawn to. And I did it regardless of whether somebody paid me for it. And then it actually became, I think this podcast was a hobby at the beginning in 2005, right? Well before there were really a lot of people listening. But sometimes that's a path, right? For us discovering those loves is by just going out and doing the things that we're drawn to. And then suddenly we realize, oh, there's actually value here that somebody is willing to pay me for, but we have to do it first.
Yeah. And that's the metaphor for a career, isn't it? It's the best metaphor for a career isn't a climbing metaphor, like a ladder or a lattice or a jungle gym. The best metaphor for a career is it's a scavenger hunt for love. That's all you're doing. You're just scavenging. You're walking into the forest, and somebody might say, well, that's not the right entrance to the forest. You're going, well, I'm just going to walk into the darn forest. I'm going to look for signs of love, and I call them red threads. I'm going to look. Your life is made up of many, many threads, a fabric of many threads. Some are white, black, gray, brown, a little up, a little down, but some of them are red threads where you just can't help yourself, like you with your podcast, when really no one was listening to podcasts. You're like, yeah, but I can't not do this. I'm going to pull on this thread and I'm going to see where it leads. And then you pull and then you pull and then you're finding more mastery and more competency, and then you're finding an audience, and then it's a scavenger hunt for love. I graduated from university in England, and my first job was in Lincoln, Nebraska. Why? I mean, at the time, I can remember saying to my dad, well, shouldn't I go to London and ply my trade there for a while or get an experience? And he was like, do you think you're going to have a different quality of experience in Nebraska? Do you think there's something there that you love? And I'm like, yeah. And I couldn't quite articulate what it was, but I'm going to pull on the thread. Well, that thread now landed me talking to you and you talking to me today. We didn't know we were going to end up here. But the metaphor as we look back is we took our love seriously, and then we scavenged. And it's like a constant, who knows what's going to be around that next corner, but I'll tell you what, love's going to be a great guide.
What a wonderful way to wrap this conversation about the book, which is actually where you actually end the book. So I love that we brought this full circle. The book is called Love and Work, How to Find What You Love, Love What You Do, and Do It for the Rest of Your Life. The author is Marcus Buckingham. Marcus, if people want to come learn more about you, obviously we want them to buy the book and read the book. More importantly, read the book. Don't just buy the book, but read the book and apply the book. But if people want to learn more about you and your work, where would you send them?
Well, on social, I'm probably most active on Instagram because it's just funner for me than anything else. So Instagram is probably good for me. And then loveandwork.org. So loveandwork.org is where me and I partnered with Harvard Business Review as a publisher of this because we kind of wanted people to take love seriously, and there's nobody more serious than HBR. loveandwork.org, anyone who wants, there's a whole six-part Love and Work Leader series. If you bought the book, it's like 6 hours of content with HBR on how do you apply this as a worker, as a team leader, but also as a parent, as a learner. In relationships, how would you take these concepts of weird, these concepts of red threads, how would you apply it to the way in which you lead all aspects of your life? So loveandwork.org is probably the best place.
Fantastic. Well, Marcus Buckingham, thanks so much for taking the time to share your wisdom with us today.
Cheers. Thanks for having me.
Hey, I hope this inspires all of you to discover what you love and activate it through your work every day. Remember, friends, cover bands don't change the world. Don't be a cover band. You need to find your unique voice if you want to thrive. We'll see you next time.